Who killed Ashley Babbitt? Trump tweeted that out recently, and he was also asked about it with a very interesting tidbit from Maria Bartiromo. Listen.
And there is speculation that this was a security detail in a leading member of Congress's security detail, a Democrat.
Whoa, this we're getting a little closer to the identity of the man who shot Ashley Babbitt through the neck, killing her. And hey, it's time to reveal the name of the man. It's Lieutenant Michael Byrd. Michael Byrd. Now, the media, by the way, knows his name. They have known it for a while. They refuse to report it. They're, you may say, protecting him. Now, this is strange because think about it. There have been a number of police shootings over the last few years. Can you think of a single case in which the identity of the officer has been systematically concealed by the media? There's no such case. So in this one case, they are preventing people from knowing what I've just told you. Why? Partly because Lieutenant Michael Byrd is black. And so we have right away a racial incident in the sense that you've got a black cop shooting and killing an unarmed white woman, who's, by the way, also a veteran. And this white woman was doing nothing more in this case than pushing her way through a window. In other words, she seems to pose no imminent or immediate danger to anyone, least of all to the cop. And yet, evidently, a, quote, internal investigation, which seems thoroughly bogus, by the way, has concluded that Lieutenant Michael Byrd felt he was in mortal danger. So in other words, evidently, he wasn't even protecting anyone else. He felt that his life was in danger. Now, in any other circumstances, I mean, just switch the races of the people, switch the ideologies around, and ask yourself this. If you have an unarmed black man coming through a window and a white cop with no warning, no firing shot in the air, shoots not just to wound or to immobilize, but to kill, and then says, even though I'm standing many feet away, even though there are lots of people around me, including lots of cops, there's no evident danger, at least mortal danger. Nevertheless, I'm going to kill this woman. Wow. And for what? Because she broke the law? Well, George Floyd broke the law. If Ashley Babbitt deserves to die just because she, quote, broke the law, why doesn't George Floyd deserve to die? Because he broke the law. So breaking the law by itself doesn't mean that an armed officer has a right to kill you. It means that they have a right to apprehend you, put you before a jury, put you before a judge, let the system take its course. That's all they're empowered to do. Now, the interesting thing about this guy, Michael Byrd, first of all, it's pretty obvious it's him. We know this because actually a sergeant at arms, Timothy Blodgett, accidentally blurted out his name in a hearing. And interestingly, C-SPAN and CNN quickly removed his name from the transcript. But there it is in the Congressional Quarterly Record, so we know exactly who it is. But you can also, by the way, match up photos of Byrd, Byrd himself, with the fellow that we see on the television screen. And by the way, he's wearing the same bracelet that he normally wears, the same lapel pin. It's quite obviously the same guy. Now, interestingly, this guy, Mike Byrd, has cleaned his own social media. He's removed all his posts. He's taken down all his personal photos. So he's obviously trying to conceal his identity. Interestingly, when you look into his background, and I have to credit some reporting here from the Tampa Tribune, or one of the Tampa newspapers, they go, Byrd has a record of mishandling his weapons. Very interesting. In fact, in February 2019, this guy took a department-issued Glock 22, by the way, the same firearm he used on Ashley Babbitt, and he left the gun loaded but unattended in a restroom in on the House side of the Capitol. And another guy was looking around, maybe coming to use the bathroom. He finds this loaded gun. And so this guy, Mike Byrd, is obviously a little careless, a little bit reckless. But the reason this cordon of protection has gone around him, not only from the authorities but from the media, is they can't afford to admit that the only lethal force used on January 6th was illicitly, inappropriately, and in violation of law, used by a black male Capitol police officer against a female unarmed Trump supporter. Admit that, and the whole January 6th narrative begins to collapse. They don't want it to collapse. They're trying to hold up this tottering edifice of lies. This is the big lie, by the way. The big lie here being that, oh, there were these seditious Trump supporters trying to overthrow the Constitution, mounting an Al-Qaeda-style attack. And so they can't afford to tell the truth about Mike Babbitt. They've got to protect him. They've got to hide his identity. They've got to pretend that Ashley Babbitt was some kind of Osama bin Laden or some kind of guy flying a plane into a building, although she manifestly was not.
World country yesterday watched these images out of Cuba, really, really unprecedented. In 62 years of communist tyranny on the island of Cuba, we have never seen, there's never been, what now is up to 40 cities in which people took to the streets organically, unorganized, grassroots, to ask for the end of that tyranny. And I think it's important for a lot of people that are new to the issue to sort of understand what that means and what it's all about. I think that the first lesson we need to take away from it is that Marxism, socialism, doesn't work. The way socialism, the way Marxism has always worked, the way it's always empowered itself, is it goes to a people and immediately divides them. It says, there is this oppressor class, and then there is this victim class, and these evil oppressors and, you know, capitalists, in the case of socialism or traditional Marxism, they oppress the victims. And what you have to do is you have to give us the power in government to take care of these oppressors, to go after these oppressors. And if you give us that power, we will deliver you security. We will protect you from the oppressors. They ask for security in exchange for freedom. That is always the price that socialism asks for, security. And what you wind up with is a country of people that hate each other, that are angry at each other. A significant portion of the people in the country have to leave, have to flee, go to jail, because they're the oppressor class. Their lives are destroyed. Their family lives are destroyed. But the socialism can't deliver the security. And when it can't deliver the security, you don't get your freedom back. And in fact, when you start to complain about that, that is when the repression comes. Well, that's what's happened in Cuba. Socialism and Marxism has done in Cuba what it has done everywhere in the world that it's been tried. It has failed. It has failed. They gave up their freedom, or they were told, give up your freedom in exchange for a world-class healthcare system. It's not a world-class healthcare system. In fact, it's a healthcare system that does not even have the ability to deal with COVID at its very basic level. That says, give up your freedom for economic security. What economic security? People are hungry, homes are crumbling, there is no economy, there is no real economy in Cuba. Give up your freedom and you'll have an education, free education for everybody. That education, number one, you're a doctor, you can drive a taxi cab in Cuba and make more money. Or number two, you get sent, forced to go overseas and work basically on slave wages, no pay, barely any pay at all. It's basically human trafficking, as our own Department of State found when it looked at the Cuban doctors program and how it's been abused. And so what's happened in Cuba is socialism has failed. It has to repress the people who complain about it. You don't get your freedom back. And like socialists always do, they have to find someone to blame. And who do they blame? Number one, they blame anybody in the country that doesn't agree with them. You're immediately a counter-revolutionary. You're immediately a pawn of the imperialists. And then, of course, they always blame the United States. The problem in Cuba for the regime is the people aren't falling for those lies anymore. They're not. The embargo, that's the first thing they blame. It's the embargo. The embargo is causing all this. Why aren't fishermen and farmers in Cuba allowed to fish or grow things and sell it to people? It's not the embargo that keeps them from doing that. It's the regime. Why can't Cubans own a small business? Why can't a Cuban do in Cuba what they can do in Miami, what they can do in Washington, what they do in countries all over the world? They can't do it in Cuba. They can't open a small business. That's not the embargo that keeps them from doing it. In fact, U.S. law allows us to trade and to do commerce with small businesses that are independently owned by Cubans. You know why Cubans can't own small businesses? It's not the embargo. It's not the U.S. It's the regime that doesn't allow it. People see these lies. How can they afford to build luxury, four-star, world-class hotels for tourists, but they cannot afford to deal with the crumbling homes that Cubans are living in, with roofs literally falling in over their head, with water leaking into operating rooms at hospitals? Look what they do with the money. Oh, it's because you don't allow more money to be sent. When an American or Cuban American sends money to their family members in Cuba in the past through Western Union, the regime takes 10% off the top, and then they take those dollars you sent, they force the Cubans to convert it into a worthless Cuban currency, they keep the dollars, and then guess what? If you want to buy anything, you got to buy it from a government store, and guess what the government store sells things for? Dollars. That's not the embargo, that's the Cuban regime that does that. And who is it that's putting people in jail? Gets your head cracked open, gets your door kicked down in the middle of the night. There are 80 people missing today, at least 80 people. Disappeared overnight, their family doesn't know where they are. That's not the embargo, that's jailing people. That's the regime. And that's what I tell people. You can open up all you want. We can pass a bill here that says, open to Cuba, 100% open. You can do whatever you want, full free trade. You can do whatever you want. At the end of the day, the Cuban regime will control that opening. It's not just what we want to do, it's what they want to do. You want to do tourism? We tried that in 2015 when the Obama changes. And you know what they did? They said, thank you. We love the fact you're coming here as tourism. Guess what? All the tourist sites are owned by a holding company named Gaesa, controlled by the Cuban military. So everything comes through our hands. You want to send them food? That's great. Guess who gets it? Alimport, which is a government, military-owned agriculture company. You can't sell it to a small grocery store in Cuba or even a food wholesaler. It goes to the Cuban government. You want to send money? They take it. You know why? Because socialism is about control. And all of these things, tourism, food, money, medicine, it's all about control. You want humanitarian aid? Let's get Red Cross. Any of these vetted NGOs in the world should be allowed to go into Cuba. They won't allow it. A, because it's embarrassing to them. They have a world-class healthcare system. Why do they need humanitarian aid? But B, because they want to control it. Send them vaccines. But if you put it in their hands, the government, the regime, guess who gets the vaccines? The people who behave. First the regime elites, then the people who behave. If you're not behaving, if you're not going along with what they want you to do, you don't get a vaccine. They will use any opening as a tool, as a weapon against their people, because that's what socialism does.
Hunter Biden is also an artist. Who knew? Well, I mean, he's an artist, kind of like he's an energy expert, or a Ukraine expert, or a China expert, or a real estate mogul. The simple truth that he's none of these things. And if you look at Hunter Biden's art, well, first of all, I'm not even sure he did any of it. It doesn't... he could, produce art in a cocaine-induced haze, but I have a feeling that he got somebody else to do this stuff. But nevertheless, he wants to sell it. He wants to sell it under his own name. And he wants to sell it clearly as a mode of access to the Biden family. The Biden racket continues with Joe Biden in the White House. It's not clear what percentage the old man is getting. Bob wants his share. I'm sure there's going to be money passed under the family table. You know, as you know, Hunter Biden, I've been talking about this on the podcast, has been paying his dad's bills. Part of the way he funnels the money right back to the corrupt father, who's the mafia don, the center of the whole operation. Now, here is the Walter Schaub, who's the ethics. He was the head of ethics. The Office of Government Ethics under Obama from 2013 to 2017. And he's talking about the White House's arrangement to allow Hunter to sell his art, and supposedly that they've built a fence around Hunter, so there's not going to be any impropriety. But listen.
A way that Hunter Biden could now become this great emerging artist and sell them for a price that matches the market that would not run afoul of ethics concerns?
Well, the thing is, it's just got the absolute appearance that he's profiting off of his father's fame. He's not selling under a pseudonym. He's not waiting till his father is out of office.
He doesn't just have the appearance that the guy is running a racket. He has been running a racket. He's been doing it for years. He's the bag man for his dad. It's really his father's racket. Now, of course, what Walter Schaub is saying is kind of obvious. There was a, the Washington Post as well as the Daily Mail have both been talking to art experts and kind of showing them Hunter Biden's art. And here's Mark Strauss, by the way, who runs a gallery in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. He goes, quote, "Nobody would ever start at these prices." We're talking about prices, by the way, up to $500,000 a painting. Think about that for Hunter Biden, not known as an artist previously. Jerry Saltz, a critic at New York Magazine, author of the book How to Be an Artist, he told Artwork News that these works could be described as, quote, "generic post-zombie formalism." He's being sarcastic. I think what he's saying is this is crap. Scott Indrisik, who's the editor-in-chief, former editor-in-chief of Modern Painters magazine, I would call it very much a hotel art aesthetic. In other words, this is the kind of thing that you see in the Holiday Inn on the wall. It's worth probably $300, if that. Certainly not $500,000. And, you know, can you imagine if, like, Donald Trump Jr. did this when Trump was in the White House? He starts doing paintings, and the paintings are a kind of gobbledygook on paper or on metal or on canvas. This would be seen as an obvious racket, an obvious attempt to exploit the connection to Trump. And of course, Jen Psaki says, well, you know, we're going to make sure that the buyers of this art are confidential. Their names will not be released. What? This is supposed to be an attempt to fight corruption? No, on the contrary. This means that the public won't know who's paying all this money for the art, won't be able to monitor and see what kind of favors are those guys getting from the Biden administration. Yeah, although this is kept confidential from the public, there's nothing to stop the guy buying the art going to the White House and saying, hey guys, listen, I've just shelled out $500,000 for a Hunter Biden painting. I think this qualifies me for a meeting with Joe Biden, don't you think? And of course, this is his MO. This is his modus operandi. This is how he functions. He'd be like, sure, you know, two nights in the Lincoln bedroom and whatever you want for your business on top of that. So this is how this stuff works. I mean, there's the attempt to camouflage the Biden name. Here's the the George Burgess Gallery, which is going to be selling this art. And by the way, this George Burgess guy is a shady character. He has a criminal record. No surprise. This guy, in his online biography of Hunter Biden, says, quote, he doesn't mention anything about Joe Biden being the president. He calls him, quote, a lawyer by trade who now devotes his life to the creative arts. So what we're seeing here is a total racket. But of course, you can't understand the Hunter Biden racket unless you see it as part of the larger racket. This is, by the way, a theme that we focused on in Trump Card, the way in which you've got this worldwide network of corruption. And this is only the end of it, the last installment, if you will, of this continuing saga. So here's a clip from the movie Trump Card, my interview with the researcher and scholar Peter Schweitzer, talking about the Biden crime family. Let's turn to Hunter Biden. In 2013, Hunter Biden accompanies his father, Joe Biden, Vice President of the United States, to China.
Hunter Biden is there because he's trying to finalize this incredible deal. It's a private equity deal expanded to $1.5 billion. The Chinese government is putting money into this deal.
And is it a deal to invest in the Chinese economy in ways that are not typically open to Western investors?
Yes, this is the key. Hunter Biden has no background in private equity. He has no background in China. He gets a deal through the Shanghai Free Trade Zone that nobody else operating in China has. The Chinese have had a strategy throughout the Asia-Pacific region of striking deals with the family members of political figures like Joe Biden because they expect favorable policies in return.
Now, the key point here is all of this is documented on Hunter Biden's laptop. There's no doubt it's Hunter Biden's laptop. You might remember when the laptop story first surfaced how 50 intelligence officers, and this just shows what deceitful crooks these people are, all said, oh yeah, this is all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation. Russian disinformation? Could they actually have sent, you know, time-coded emails under Hunter Biden's personal email? Could they have figured all that out, rigged his whole browser history, manufactured Hunter Biden's own texts and send them to other people with replies that would come contemporaneously? Did the Russians do that? It was manifestly preposterous. And yet they did it. Why? Because it was a brazen lie. They knew the media would go with it. They knew that this is a way of, by and large, protecting the Biden family through the election. That was the point. It shows the depth of corruption of these intelligence officers and how they're all in, how they're all really partisan hacks. But on top of that, the laptop now shows Joe Biden's direct involvement. Here he is in Georgetown eating with a bunch of Ukrainian officials who are, by the way, funneling money to Hunter Biden. There he is meeting with some Mexican businessmen. And of course, Hunter Biden and his business partner are making deals with Carlos Slim and Miguel Alemán Velasco. And Biden is right there and they're taking photos together and they're meeting in Biden's vice presidential home. And all of this is right there. It's like DNA. It's indisputable, and yet the media won't touch it. They're pretending like this is not a story. It's almost like they're telling their readers that if you wish it not to be a story, we're going to make that wish come true by not making it a story, even though they know that it is a story, and it is very damning. And precisely because it is damning, they're circling the wagons around the Biden family, not in order to expose the Biden family corruption, but to make sure it never gets out. The media here can't acknowledge the truth. They haven't learned anything from the past. They're not going to. They can't do it. Why? Because at the end, these guys are like the deep state 50 intelligence officers themselves, part of the deceitful Biden crime family operation themselves.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Dennis Prager Show. All right, let's go now to one of my favorite writers in the country, Ann Coulter. Ann, welcome back to the Dennis Prager Show.
I am so happy to be back with you, Dennis.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. I want to say something, and my listeners know this is... I have zero reason in the world to say this outside of I believe it. Believe it or not, with all your fame and with all of your writing and with all of everything, you are underrated as a thinker.
Thank you.
Do you know that my wife is actually reading me from your book?
Oh, God bless her. You made well done.
I did. You're right. It's true. but I want you to know, demonic, how the liberal mob is endangering America. Your latest book is a significant work. Now, the fact that one laughs out loud every third page is an added bonus.
Thank you.
Usually serious thought and cracking up don't go together.
You are my ideal reader.
I am. Well, that's right. No, my wife and I are your ideal readers. That is, we are. You're right. But people need to. I mean, she was reading to me the part on the French Revolution. You did your work. You know the French Revolution.
I do now. Yeah. And what was interesting to me about that was that I have a lot of really smart friends, much smarter than I am. They can tell me about the Russian czars, obscure facts about the Civil War. None of them knew about the French Revolution, and that's when I decided liberals are hiding it from us because they know it's the history of them.
The best is, most Americans, or at least, well, I don't even know if that's true anymore, a lot of people heard of Bastille Day, right?
Yeah.
The liberation, the French Revolution beginning with the liberation of the king's terrible, torturous prison. How many prisoners were in the Bastille when they liberated it?
Six.
Okay. How many people know that? Six. And they were having lunch.
Yeah.
A good French lunch. They had a chef making their lunch.
Yes, and part of the reason they stormed it was because they considered it an eyesore and they didn't like the cannons poking out of the top of the Bastille.
Yes, and then what did they do to the guy who ran the place who wanted to just have a peaceful interaction with the mob?
Chopped off his head in the gutter. They had, I think it was a butcher who did it, got down on his hands and knees with a pocket knife and cut his, after parading him through the town so that people could jeer at him and jab at him with their bayonets, chopped off his head and paraded it around on a pike.
Right. I want people to understand this notion. We have very similar instincts. I actually fear crowds.
Yes.
I don't mean a crowd at a football game.
Yes.
But wherever there is almost wherever there is a large number. I remember it from college. It's what started me.
Yes.
When the kids would mob the classrooms and take over classrooms in protesting the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No. Well, that's where the title demonic comes from. Mobs are always demonic. And I think you may be a little unique among Americans, which is why part of the point I want people to take away from this book, I think Americans have lost their natural aversion to mobs. Mobs are always bad things. We have a government with a rule of law and individual rights. The lowliest person can go into court and assert rights against, you know, multimillionaire George Soros. You don't need to run out on the streets and bang pots and pans together.
That is such an important point. The individual can get what he needs through the process. Why have a mob?
Yes.
You know, just today I'll be covering this week the mobs taking over in Greece.
So, yes. Oh, yes. It's a very European or a continental European phenomenon. It is not native to America. I think Americans. I think things shifted with the civil rights movement, because for once a mob was being deployed on behalf of a good cause. Though, as I point out in the civil rights chapter, I think the real hero of civil rights is Thurgood Marshall. I elevate him to a hero in my book, in the tradition of the American Revolution, with Martin Luther King more in the tradition of the French Revolution, which is funny because I never thought of him that way when I was reading his later opinions as a Supreme Court justice when
mm-hmm.
I was in law school.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll be back with Ann Coulter to come back. I want to ask her, in case you folks didn't catch it, and I'm sure most didn't, it was a phenomenon. I got a whiff of it from YouTube, I'm not certain, when she was on with Piers Morgan. The book is an important book, Demonic, How the Liberal Mob is Endangering America. Ann Coulter, my guest. I'm Dennis Prager. And it's a delight to speak to a woman I am happy to say is a major thinker. She's known for her wit, which is it's a very rare talent, but she's a deep thinker, and I love her work. And Demonic is the latest book. These are not books on politics written for 6 months duration and then to be used as doorstops. This is a book you'll actually read and want to read again. The mob issue is a very serious one. It's one that frightens me as well. For example, and that's why you have one thesis in this book. This is not a collection of columns.
Right.
The 60s, the mob goes to college. Give an example there.
Well, you had the whole SDS and Weatherman coming out of that insanity. But on the college campuses, it parallels the French Revolution. You could never really see what they were upset about. It wasn't clear. They just, you know, it was fun throwing rocks at police, and the college administrators constantly wanted to back down, and the police constantly wanted not to back down. There were a few, you know, rare examples of manliness back then. Governor Ronald Reagan of California, and eventually Richard Nixon as president. Other than that, there was a lot of backing down, and it turns out backing down to a mob does not help.
I want you to know, I have said to my listeners frequently, when I was at Columbia, I was scarred, and I don't overstate things.
Mm-hmm.
It changed me permanently when I saw the weakness. That's why when you used manliness, I'm so reacting positively. When I saw the weakness in the deans and the college administrators in the face of the mob closing down classes for whatever particular position they had on Vietnam or what have you, I realized that this was not where moral strength was, the university.
Yes, and it eventually leads to a conflagration at Kent State, but that shut down the university protest pretty fast.
That's correct. By the way, she has some very hilarious titles, like, for example, The French Revolution, Part Deux. Deux is two in French. Come for the beheadings, stay for the rapes. I mean, you're funny. You're just downright funny.
Thank you.
By the way, I think in the annals of American television interviews, yours and Piers Morgan will have to be in the Hall of Fame. He would ask you a question. then you had the temerity to use the terms liberals and conservatives. Is that right? Do I have
Is
it right?
That what was upsetting him? All I knew is it took me, I think in a half an hour, I answered three questions. Because it would take me 10 minutes and I would just power through. He'd keep interrupting and I wouldn't relent. And I would power through and finally answer that question.
Right. And the joke is, if he has some, you know, if he has Lady Gaga on,
right.
She gets to answer a question as if she's a major thinker. Then he has a major thinker on, and she's not allowed 10 seconds to develop a thought.
Yes, well, what struck me last week is, you know, they're always sneering at Fox and conservatives, the anti-intellectuals, and CNN. That's for the serious thinkers.
Right.
Well, I had three interviews on CNN, one with Fareed Zakaria, one with Piers Morgan, one with Joy Behar. The only one who asked me a question about my book was the comedian, Joy Behar.
No kidding.
The other two manifestly hadn't read it, had no idea what it was about. Of course, Fareed edits his show when it goes to tape before it goes on air. And he said to me, now you have read some of my book. I think your listeners have a general idea, the theme of the book. Fareed said to me, and he promised me up and down, oh, I'm an author. We'll definitely have a segment on your book. No segment on the book. He said to me at one point, now politicians need to compromise, but you and your book, Demonic Anne, say that the Republicans shouldn't compromise. And I looked at him slack-jawed and said, where do I say that? You haven't cracked this book.
And was that in the final version? It was cut?
Yes, it was.
He actually cited you saying something you didn't say.
No, he cut it.
No. But the thing that he cut...
Oh, sorry, I don't know. I assume he cut both his question and my answer. I didn't actually see it. I just asked everyone who saw it. Did you hear me tell him that he hadn't cracked my book? And they all said no, they didn't see that.
That's fascinating. So Joy Behar comes out to be the heroine.
Yeah. She's the intellectual on CNN. They don't read books.
It is something. Do you still go to campuses and with bodyguards?
Yes. Pretty much anybody who speaks on a college campus needs to, though.
No, pretty much anybody on the right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, that's an important...
I conserve.
Yes,
no, and
right.
That enrages me, that Michael Moore, James Carville, Keith Olbermann, they can walk any place in America. I can't. You can't.
That's right. The last time I was at UC Santa Barbara, the police escorted me. I don't think I need one, but it is. They assume it. That's what's most interesting. The college authorities assume if a conservative is coming, we need to supply police.
Right. And
what does that say about the left?
Right. Well, curiously, in my experience, and I wrote about this about three books back, contrary to my expectation, it's at the better schools that I could probably go without a bodyguard. You know, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, the equivalent. It's usually the total Bush League schools where they have, you know, some smart kids. They're all in college Republicans. With professors like Ward Churchill, they can't even spell my name. They don't know who I am, but they know they're supposed to hate me. And they can't quite articulate it, so they throw stuff. They rush at you. They try to, you know, throw noxious liquids at you, smack you in the face. No, you need a bodyguard at some college campuses.
Well, I just want to say that the point that just because I do want people to read your book, this, it can't be overstated how important this mob thing is, and you are so right about Europe. And like most of the bad ideas in America, this too comes from Europe.
Yes.
Look, we saw it now in England. Remember in England, God forbid kids should have to pay at all for their education.
And
you had riots.
Yeah. No, and I think we could start seeing them with the public sector. Well, we are seeing them to some extent. But you never know when it can break out.
It did break out. What happened in Madison, Wisconsin at the state capitol?
Right.
Why is that not a mob?
And I quote Dostoevsky from his book The Demons, which was as prescient about the Russian Revolution as Edmund Burke was about the French Revolution. Dostoevsky talks about how the Russian people just thought life has been so peaceful, nothing can go wrong. Let's just coddle the youth. They're play acting revolutionaries. They're not real revolutionaries. No, you can never coddle a mob. You cannot reason with a mob. A mob can only be smashed, and it can happen any place, any time. Even in a peaceful rule of law society like America, we've had outgrowths of it now and then. It has been smashed. It was smashed with enthusiasm and alacrity by George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. I don't know that Americans are aware of that right now, and I'm hoping my book will convince them.
Well, that's the hope. The book is demonic, and the book's title is demonic. The book is angelic, but the title is demonic. And just keep it up. That's all I can say.
Thank you, Dennis Prager.
You're very welcome. The book, again, is up at DennisPrager.com. She is brilliant. She is knowledgeable. She does a lot of research, and she's hilarious. I'm Dennis Prager.